long ago in a galaxy far, far away.
Episode 107, Michael Cook. Ancient religions, modern politics.
You got it right, David. Well done. I tried it earlier, listeners, and failed. We're the Religious Studies Project. He's David Robertson.
He's Thomas Coleman.
Christopher Carter. Damn you. And we're in the Wash Bar, still in the interval, in the Internet Equals Global Conference. This week we've got an interview from Knut, speaking with Michael Cook, as you've just heard there. And we're in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions, and you're going to have your ears given some joy.
I had the great pleasure to introduce Professor Michael Cook, 2014 Holberg Prize winner. Professor Cook is probably most known for his research on Islamic history, and he has been awarded several other prizes and honoraries for his scholarly work. He is also known for books such as The Quran, A Very Short Introduction, and A Brief History of the Human Race, both translated into many languages, both European and non-European. Michael Cook is currently a professor at the Department of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. And since I did not have the opportunity to book a flight over there, he has instead joined me here in Bergen, Norway, through the magic powers of Skype. So hello to you, sir. It's a great pleasure to have you here, and congratulations on winning the Holberg Prize for outstanding contribution to research in the arts and humanities, social science, law, or theology.
Many thanks.
As some may have noticed, I did not go into much detail on what exactly you have done since you started out as a student at Cambridge in the late 50s. That is because I wanted to give you the chance to introduce parts of your own history yourself. And maybe we could just begin with the start. That is, when and why did you decide that you wanted to take on history and make a career out of it?
Right. Okay, let me answer with respect to history, and then maybe we should move to specifically Near Eastern history, right? Or Islamic history. Maybe I should start by explaining that until the age of 15, I was a convinced scientist. I was going to be a physicist. And I think this was a result of some very good teaching I had in Edinburgh. And when Mr. Booth, our chemistry teacher, told us we were going to study combustion. And so he then wrote up on the blackboard the phlogiston theory, the 18th century theory of combustion. And we wrote it all down and believed it. Then he said, but this is science. We have to do some experiments. And we did an experiment, and it confirmed the theory. And then he said, but in science, one experiment is not enough. We must do another. And we did another, and the theory fell flat on its face. And that was such a good piece of teaching. Then he explained about oxygen. And we did experiments, and they were confirmed. It was confirmed. But then that was such a good piece of science teaching that I was definitely going to be a scientist. And then when it was either 15 or 16, we used to specialize very early in England in those days. And so I had to make my choice, and I chose a group that did maths, and physics. And it so happened that what we were doing was conceptually very boring at the beginning. And after 2 weeks, I couldn't take it anymore. And I went to see my maths teacher, Mr. Unwin. I disturbed him on a Sunday afternoon, I think. And he looked hard at me and he said, as a mathematician, you're all right, but you're nothing special. And I think that was the best bit of career advice I ever had. And I then left that group and went to joined a group that did history and English literature. Now, the English literature I was never very good at, but the history, I learned how to do that. So that put me on the route to be a historian.
Yeah, it seems like it was good advice because you have done some great things, which I want to sort of slowly touch upon. So when you started at Cambridge, you started out with English and European history, as well as Turkish and Persian?
Right. Okay, now in Cambridge, they have the system where you can do a part one, as they call it, in one subject for, say, 2 years, then a part two in some other subject. So what I did was a part one in history, and history meant English and European history, not Welsh or Irish or Scottish, and definitely nothing outside Europe. So I did history with the idea that I would learn how history is done, a sort of state of the art. Of course, the art has moved on since then, but that was state of the art then. And my plan from the beginning was that I would then move into, that I would then change to what they called Oriental studies and learn a couple of Near Eastern languages and then put the two together and do the history of the Near East. And I think this was maybe the one rational choice that I made in my in that somehow I had appreciated that in the field of English European history, there's overpopulation. You know, too many people are doing research in it. Whereas in the field of Near Eastern history or Islamic history, there was underpopulation. And therefore, whatever talent I had would give me a greater reward there than in English or European history.
So it was a bit of pragmatism in there, I guess.
Yes, I have to say that.
But was it hard to begin with the languages? I guess both Turkish and Persian is quite far from our own.
Certainly. Now, and with Turkish, I had a great advantage, not the greatest possible advantage, but an advantage in that my father was an archaeologist. And you know, his subject was Greek archaeology. But the Greeks, of course, in ancient times colonized the west coast of what's now Turkey and many other places. And so I was taken to Turkey in part as a child. And then again, when I was 19, my father was going out to Turkey to do survey work, not excavation, but going from village to see what the villagers found and to try to identify the exact locations of some ancient Greek cities that were known by name, but nobody knew exactly where they were. And I went with him. And in preparation for that, I began to learn some Turkish. And then in the course of traveling with him, my Turkish began to improve. And I think the next summer we also went, and then I used to take the newspaper and read the whole front page every day and memorize the words I didn't know and so on. So that before I actually formally started to do Turkish at Cambridge, I had a foundation in the language. Persian, that was something a bit new.
And in 1966, if I got it right, you started out as a lecturer at the School of Oriental and African Studies. And what did you do there?
Right. Now, I was appointed to be a lecturer in economic history. They had what I think was a very good, at SOAS, you know, in those days, we had various branches of history. One of them was Middle Eastern, one was South Asian, one was East Asian. And they conceived the idea of having an economic historian in each of these branches. And so I was appointed to the Middle Eastern branch to be an economic historian because my research had been on economic history. One of the peculiar things about my career is that I actually did very little economic history in that job because my interest shifted elsewhere.
Yeah, and your first publication was on sort of economic history, right? On the population
pressure in rural Anatolia.
Yeah, because your focus shifted to Islam,
yes,
right?
Yes, it did.
What was it about Islam that you found so fascinating or interesting?
Right. Now, primarily, I got into it through history. And in fact, there's a key figure who comes into this, namely Albert Hourani, who was one of the prominent people in the field of Middle Eastern studies. In England at that time, he was in Oxford. And he was somebody who took a strong and genuine interest in the careers of younger scholars. And so he knew me from time to time. We would meet and I would tell him what I was doing. And one year he was going on leave and he needed somebody to give his lectures on Islamic history from the beginning to the 11th century. And he asked if I would be interested in doing that. So every week I used to go to Oxford and lecture on this subject, which previously I knew very little about. And this was my introduction to those centuries of Islamic history. And I found it so fascinating that increasingly that was what I wanted to work on. and not the Ottoman economic history that I was really, really supposed to be doing. And of course, and what I should add is that, you know, as soon as you go into the beginnings of Islamic history, you are talking about religion. And so, I mean, that naturally led me to Islam.
And moving from economics to religion, were there some challenges there that you hadn't met before?
I'm not sure that there were any real challenges in the sense that, you know, thinking about any kind of history, it's all really, in a way, very similar. You know, it needs the same parts of your brain to operate in the same kind of way. But I think one thing that I did experience, I mean, when I came of age in England, everybody knew that religion was something of the past. It no longer signified. It was not important. And in fact, I mean, when I was doing my research on economic history in Turkey, I remember one member of the staff of the archives suspected that I was counting the number of Christians. And I tried to explain to him that actually the Christians were a nuisance for me because they didn't pay the same taxes, so I couldn't integrate them into my data. I mean, for me, it was a matter of complete indifference what the religion of these peasants was. And I think my moving into early Islamic history is, so to speak, one small part of the much larger intellectual change that was taking place at the time, that maybe religion is not so unimportant after all.
Yeah, you may say that, but then again, it was in the 60s you first see those secularization theories, which fits with the impression that religion is going away,
yes,
at least in some parts, yes, of the world. It's a good reminder because today we assume the opposite, that religion has everything to do with,
yes,
it, I guess.
Yes.
Perhaps I'm a bit biased, but yeah.
We're both biased.
I guess so. So you lectured at SOAS nearly 20 years, right?
It was 20 years, that's right.
And during that time, you published a book with the Danish historian Patricia Krohne.
That's right.
Exactly. Or something like that. Called Hagarism.
Yes.
And that book caused some controversy, at least within the study of Islam. Could you maybe elaborate a bit on that?
Okay, right. We had the original and youthful idea. Now, let me begin by saying, and we had been exposed to a lot of very radical skepticism about the historical content of the Islamic tradition, and skepticism considerably more radical than anything that I would espouse at the present day. I mean, there are very real problems with this early Islamic historiography, but I don't think they're quite as drastic as we thought they were then. So against that background, I began to realize, and so did she, that there were, in fact, a number of non-Islamic sources that were more or less contemporary with the rise of Islam and which had things to say that, without any doubt, are interesting and still are interesting. And what we tried to do was to replace the Islamic account of the origins of Islam with an account based on these external sources. Now, I mean, in retrospect, I don't think that our attempt worked. I mean, it was original, it was interesting, it was worth trying. But I don't actually think it was right. And it's in that sense that I've distanced myself from the book since then.
So the historical hypothesis that you put forward in that book, that's the thing that you don't agree with anymore.
I think that's right. Now, there are many other things in that book, and I haven't read it for a very, very long time. And maybe when I retire, I might read it again and see what I still agree with. But I think there probably are things in that book that have been quite formative for the way in which I approach things, even though this wouldn't be obvious to anyone on the outside.
Yeah, because from what I've read about it, people point out that it was rather the approach to look at outside sources and to get to sort of second guess the established view that was sort of groundbreaking here. And it took the Islamic studies to a different path or on another level, sort of.
Yeah, I think it may have had some impact in that respect, and if so, that was a good impact. I mean, you never know when something that you're part of is something that you really started yourself, or whether it was in the air or something like that. But I mean, certainly those sources had been almost completely forgotten for a long time. You know, I think, you know, because of the development in Islamic, I mean, you know, when you had the field dominated by the Germans of the later 19th century, they all knew not only Arabic, but also Syriac and Greek and Latin. You know, they had it all. And so it was much easier for them to go to sources like this than it is for people these days who tend to be brought up just on Arabic. You know, they don't have the facility to go back. Although I think largely because of this shift, this increasing use of non-Islamic sources, we do now have a lot more people who can go to and fro. And that's good. I mean, we have here at Princeton, we have an assistant professor who teaches Syriac. And mostly he doesn't teach Syriac to people who are going to become scholars of Syriac. It's to people who work on late antiquity in a sort of Greek-Roman context or on the early Islamic period. Those are the people he's teaching it to. And it's been very fertile.
Yeah, we have some of those in Norway as well, actually, that do Syriac, which to me seems like the hardest thing, but yeah. The range of your publication list is quite large. You have the small, short, brief books, like the Quran, a very short introduction.
Right.
And you have the books, or the book you claim is brief, but it's a bit larger.
It is, yes, I'm afraid.
It's brief of being in a history of the human race, but it's a bit larger. And I haven't obtained it yet, but you have also the large book, Commanding Right for Being Wrong. And I wondered, what do you like to write best of those, the short or the large ones?
Well, of course, and there's something that there's something easy about writing the short ones in that the project doesn't last so long. It doesn't dominate your life for so long. You can do it, and then you've done it, and then you go to something else. But I think the actual experience of writing, I think I really find it all very similar. In that, what you're doing all the time, it's like, I mean, shall we say, you're seeing that this piece of the jigsaw puzzle belongs here. Ah, I didn't see that before, and then you put it there. And whether this happens to be a tiny detail that goes in a footnote in a 700-page book, or it's something historically quite large that fits into some very short book like that, I don't think it makes very much difference to the actual experience that one has of researching and writing.
So what is it then about writing that you sort of most appreciate?
I think the sense that, my kind of natural default mental condition is an experience of fog, shall we say. And then I have to work very hard to get some clarity out of that. And, when I've written a sentence and I feel, yes, I really understand what that says, and it says what I meant. Now, there's a very good satisfaction there.
Yeah, someone has said to write is to think, or something like that. I think that's exactly the mode that many people relate to. And what I noticed first, I think, about your books is the footnotes and the appendices and all the details, which I quite like. And also you go into quite detail in the prefaces, how you transcribe the different languages and stuff like that. It seems you are pretty taken with the details of things.
Yes. I mean, I hate it when I have students who can't get the little things right. I mean, I think it's not that I'm obsessed by little things to the exclusion of bigger things, but simply that, if you produce work that has visibly rotten foundations, it's not good for your reputation, and it's not going to be good for your sense of satisfaction with what you've done. I mean, bigger things do rest on smaller things.
Right. Is that why you spent 15 years on Commanding Right for Being Wrong, to get all the details right?
Certainly, if I... Okay, yeah, I mean, after I drafted the entire book, I didn't have any leave around then, but I spent two whole summers checking all the references. And I'm very glad I did, because even though you think you're doing everything right while you're doing it, when you go back with a fresh eye, two years later, you suddenly see something and you say, how could I have done that? How could I have got that wrong? So that it was very worthwhile. So that's, say, two out of the 15 years that went by on making sure I had the details right. But in most of the 15 years, it simply represents the fact that I'd taken this particular value and I was trying to chase it through the entire tradition as far as I could. And there is simply so much of that tradition that there's no way you can wrap it up in a hurry. So I really did need to spend 15 years to do that properly.
15 years is quite a long time, I guess, and perhaps it's becoming a longer time in sort of this game of research in the humanities. Do you think there is still room for such long-term projects within the academy?
I think it probably depends on how many children you have and whether you're trying to send them to college in a country like this. In other words, I mean, the fundamental point, of course, is I had tenure. And with tenure, I mean, if you want to become Deadwood, you can. Nobody will stop you. And I wanted to write this book so that I could use my time that way. Now, did this have an opportunity cost? Yes, I'm sure it did. If I'd been producing more things as we went along, I would probably have got larger raises in my salary. And over the years, that would have added up to something significant. But, I think my lifestyle was really developed in Mrs. Thatcher's Britain. And academics in Mrs. Thatcher's Britain could not have a lavish lifestyle. And when I came here and was paid twice as much, I really didn't know what to do with the sort of extra. I found sometimes when I've been on leave, I can live very comfortably on half my salary. So that the financial opportunity cost hasn't really hurt me in any significant way. Of course, the other side of it was, people started to say, Michael Cook, he was so promising, but he's no longer productive. And then eventually I produce this enormous book and it lands on their desks and they say, oops, maybe he was productive. But I mean, there was a cost there, no doubt, during those 15 years. But you can still do it if you have tenure. And I think it's the kind of thing that should be done in different ways, in different fields of academic life.
And then when you went on and spent 2 years on writing the complete brief history of human race, and you write in the introduction that you felt you had freed your time to do something else, what inspired you to write a brief history of the human race?
That really goes back quite a long way. When I was still at SOAS, still back in London, at one stage, it was decided by the department to have a first-year course that was an introduction to the history of Africa and Asia. And I did it jointly with a colleague. Now, as far as he was concerned, history began in late antiquity. Anything before that, he wanted nothing to do with. Also, as far as he was concerned, history was something that happened in Asia, didn't happen in Africa. So I simply took over everything that was before late antiquity and the whole of African history. And that was a fascinating time, learning from almost nothing enough to be able to give them lectures to first-year undergraduates, that they at least had the illusion that an expert was speaking to them. So that really got me into something close to world history. And, after I'd done that, I thought, I know a bit about Asia and a bit about Africa, a bit about Europe. Why don't I know anything about the Americas? So I did a little bit of reading on that and about Australia. And then when I came to Princeton for many years, I did nothing like that. But eventually, and I forget, Jared Diamond published his book, Guns, Germs, and Steel. And that sort of that really revived my interest in this kind of thing. And I then put together a course, an undergraduate course again, and sort of based in a way in what I'd done long before in London, but considerably changed. And I taught that course, I think, twice. And then That's right. I'd finished with the 700-page book. And that left me sort of slightly, how can I put it, intoxicated. It left me in a mental state where I was liable to do something sort of unusual, risky, like writing this book on world history. And I was on leave that year, so that I used, I think, half the year to write that book and half the year to do something else. I've forgotten what that was. But it came very fast when I eventually wrote it.
Something completely different, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
And how do you find the field of global history? Is it just, I call it didactic treats, or are there something to be brought up from that perspective?
I think, first of all, certainly from the point of view of teaching students, it's a good thing that, I mean, they live in this world, and it's a rather globalized world in the way it wasn't 100 years ago, and they need to know something about it. So I'm entirely in favor of that. I don't think I would have wanted to spend my career as a researcher in global history. I mean, you know, obviously there are perfectly good things you can do there, but you know, having gone up to take a satellite sort of eye view, I wanted to come back down again, you know, to my region. But what I would say is that even at the level of research with footnotes, I think that knowing about other cultures than the one that you study and the one that you live in is a really good thing, because it helps you to think of questions that you wouldn't have thought of otherwise, and maybe even suggest possible answers that you can try out. So I think it's actually, I mean, you know, with my graduate students, if they're not studying just the Middle East, they go into the history department, they take a course in European history. And sometimes I say to them, why are you so Eurocentric? You know, what's wrong with East Asia? What's wrong with Africa? You know, why don't you study something there? And in career terms, it also makes sense because then, you know, when they go to their first job, especially if it's in a liberal arts college, into a history department, the chair of the department is going to ask them to, at short notice, to teach a course on, oh, it has to be African history this semester, or it's East Asian history. Our East Asianist is on leave. Somebody has to teach it. You teach it. So that this kind of flexibility is certainly career-wise good. But I think, you know, simply in terms of research. For example, I mean, there's a paper of mine that is long and full of footnotes about early Muslim attitudes towards writing down traditions from the Prophet. And in the course of researching that, I also did reading about the oral transmission of the Vedas. I was not reading Sanskrit. I was reading, you know, Western Indological studies. But I mean, that certainly helped to sharpen my sort of mental framework for considering the Islamic case.
And this perhaps takes us over to talking about your forthcoming book, Ancient Religions, Modern Politics, which is a comparative work.
Yes, it is. It's explicitly comparative.
It comes out late March?
Yes, the 23rd is the data that I've been told. And I have it right here, since you showed one of my books is this one.
I'm very much looking forward to pick it up and read it. Here you sort of move out from just Islam, but Islam seems to be the main focus, but you also
yes.
take in Hinduism and...
Yes, Catholicism, yes.
What did you find rewarding or useful with that comparative view?
I think the main thing it enabled me to do was to identify, at least to my own satisfaction, what things are distinctive about the Islamic case of religion in politics, and what things are just you know, the kind of thing you can expect to find anywhere, more sharply than I could have done otherwise.
And have you some teasers or something you want to sell the book on?
I'm not sure I have exactly anything that I want to sell the book on, except that obviously it has a certain topical interest. But and maybe I could put it like this. I think we've gone since the last 50 years from a kind of worldview that religion doesn't matter. Our religion doesn't matter to us, and the religions of people out there in other parts of the world, if they still take them seriously, it's because they're so backward. And in due course, they will be like us too. And we've gone now to a situation where people keep writing books saying, God is back everywhere, or everywhere except in Western Europe. And I think actually that this is in a way just as wrong as the 50s perspective, in the sense that, you know, when you really start going region by region, you look at China, and in terms of surveys there, and the number of people who have no particular religion, and maybe they have exactly, to use your term, a certain amount of spirituality, but they don't have a real religion, is enormous. Now, of course, you have to factor in the communist past there, but Japan is not so different. And you even come to this country, which we think of as being, by contrast to Europe, fantastically religious. And indeed it is if you go down to the Bible Belt. But I mean, there have been significant shifts in this country, in recent surveys that kind of are edging it closer to the European model. So I think that really, Latin America, yes, and there's some real Catholicism, some real Pentecostalism, but also a lot of religiously pretty indifferent people. So I mean, one has now to have a picture that there is Western Europe at one end of a spectrum, and there is the Islamic world at another end, but there is quite a lot spread out in between. And that's something I think that... I don't know if I can sell my book on it, but it's something worth saying that I've said.
Absolutely. And I think you can sell the book on that note. Okay. What's next for you then? What are you working on now? I heard some rumors about calendars, but...
Okay, now the rumors they didn't come out of nothing, in the sense that maybe about 10 years ago, I got interested in calendars. It was one of those summers when I was checking the footnotes of the enormous book, and I found I could do that from, shall we say, 9 o'clock until 6 o'clock. But beyond that, I just couldn't take it. And so I spent the evenings reading about calendars. And again, it was very typical of me, I suppose, in that what I was trying to do was to get the Islamic case in a comparative perspective, and so that I could realize what was distinctive and what wasn't. And I mean, what is really very distinctive about the Islamic case is that you have completely dropped the solar year. Now, using lunar months, that's very common. The Chinese and the Indians, lots of people used lunar months, as opposed to the months that we have, which are just not lunar anymore. But people combined lunar months with a solar year. And they did it through this messy business of intercalation. Every now and again, you have to put in an extra month. And then you have all sorts of problems, like when do you put it in, and who is the person who has the authority to say we're going to put it in, and so on. And that's what you completely reject in the Islamic case. You have a lunar year that has nothing to do with the sun. It's 12 lunar months. And getting that straight in my mind, that this is actually something very exceptional, that was interesting and valuable, and gave me a perspective on the Islamic case. But then what I did was to put the essence of what I had to say about all that into my brief history of the human race. And having done that, that's sort of killed the subject for me, in the sense I'm not sure I now want to go back and do the same thing with footnotes. I prefer to do something else.
And what's that something else, if I may ask?
Okay. Well, right now, of course, I'm not doing anything except trying to keep my head above water with teaching and searches to fill our positions here and things like that. But last summer, I started on a project that I've had at the back of my mind for decades, which is to write a fairly short history of the Islamic world. No, not that short, but not as long as the 700-page book. And this arises from the fact that it really arises from my teaching, the fact that over the years, I've taught different parts of this history, different periods, different regions. And, when you teach You come up with ideas for how to package things, how to present things, what are good examples of some larger trend, what are stories that grab your attention, what are funny stories that will grab the attention of students. And yeah, so I have a considerable investment there. And I don't want to take it to the grave, so to speak. And to, I prefer to put it in the form of a book, which I hope, I mean, unlike some of the things I've written, will be one where the pages turn relatively easily. It would be a book that could serve as a kind of textbook for students, but not a very formal textbook, but also for people with a general interest and, you know, who don't know much about Islamic history but would like to know something. That's the kind of book that I'm trying to write now.
It seems to me that many of your writing projects emerge from teaching. Is that correct?
Yes. I think that is right. Yes, it's absolutely right.
And you still teach undergrads at Princeton?
Yes. Yes. Well, Princeton is a the culture here is that every professor has to teach undergraduates. Graduates are a kind of a luxury, but undergraduates are what this institution is about.
And I guess some would find that sort of not so fulfilling, and some would. And I guess you are in the last part, those who find it rewarding. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, I find it in a way quite stressful because for undergraduates you have to stand there and give a lecture. And that's never been something that's come completely easily to me. I've now had a lot of practice, so I can give the appearance that I do it easily, but I don't. Whereas graduate teaching, you don't do that kind of thing. But if I feel that I gave a good lecture, that I really got something across, then I have a high from that. If I feel I did it badly, I have a low from that. And then and typically, of course, here you'll have every week two lectures and one discussion class. And those discussion classes are, chemistry is much more important there. The chemistry of interaction with the students, it's an interactive thing. And sometimes they can be very hard, hard to get the students moving. And you'll continue thinking, what am I going to bring up next? But the one I had this last semester, I think it's maybe the best I've ever had. There was never a moment. Now, we were discussing readings, mainly primary source ones that I'd assigned, and they'd read them. And, I used to be brutal, and I don't just say, does anyone have anything to say? I say, Alice, what did you think about this? And Alice has to say something because she knows he has to say something. She has actually read it. So that was, I credit that to me. But what I credit to the students is they were just a very articulate group. They were interested. They were excited. They always came up with things. So it's always a rewarding experience.
I find that rewarding as well. That's most fun part of being a teacher, I think, when there's some response and engagement. It sounds like you're not afraid to put some expectations on the students.
Certainly, yes. Yes. And sometimes I get a certain amount of resistance. I mean, maybe 10 or 15 years ago in this very office, I had a young student who was very angry at the comments I'd made on her first paper. I mean, I told her that it was very badly structured. And one of the things I particularly mentioned was that I wanted to know the subject of a paragraph when I read the first sentence, and I couldn't make head or tail of it from reading from the first sentences. And so for some reason, the only time we could meet was 10 o'clock at night. So 10 o'clock at night, we had this showdown, and she told me about how from in her high school, they didn't tell her to write like this. And I said, well, this is not your high school, it's Princeton. So anyway, we kind of made peace, a truce, shall we say. And then maybe 10 years later, I got an email from her saying she was in law school and she just submitted her first paper. And her instructor had complimented her on the excellent structure of her paper and the fine topic sentences she had at the beginning of each paragraph. So
mission accomplished.
It's all worth it. Yes, exactly.
That's great. Let's move on to the topic of the humanities. You have a long-standing career within the humanities, and I'm sure there always has been these discussions about its place and relevance to the sciences and society in general, at least since C.P. Snow wrote his Two Cultures.
Yes.
Much of the present debate, though, is rather discouraging in terms of study programs being shut down and for young PhD students to actually hope to get a research position. So I wanted to ask you, if you are only allowed to give one piece of advice to a PhD student, what would that advice be?
Then I suppose, I mean, but this is, so to speak, career advice, not intellectual advice.
Is it either or is it the same thing?
Well, I could do both. But I mean, the general career advice I would give is do some serious market research about the speciality that you're thinking of entering before you enter it. You know, try to find out by talking to graduate students currently in it how they feel about their prospects for employment, because they can differ enormously. I mean, for example, I think some of the people on this campus who do the best job of preparing their graduate students for the job market are the people in the English department. Now, that's very good, but there's a downside to it, which is the reason that they've put so much thought and energy and intelligence into it is that they have a very hard time marketing the graduate students that they produce. Whereas I've led in that respect a rather sheltered life, particularly since 9/11. We are in demand. And, you know, it does happen that you have a graduate student who takes a long time to find a job and who goes to a very kind of low-grade college to start with. But, I mean, eventually, in nearly every case, they end up with a decent position. So that we're much luckier in that respect than the English department. And it also means, of course, that we've put less thought into how to market our graduate students. That's the downside of that. But so I think my advice, so to speak, if someone came to me and said, shall I go to and study English as a graduate student or shall I do Near Eastern studies? I would say, well, if you have the linguistic abilities, Near Eastern studies would be safer.
And that was perhaps an intellectual advice as well. Namely, learn languages.
Certainly, yes.
And also an ongoing discussion is about how to assess usefulness of the humanities within society. It seems like it's easy to assess usefulness for technology or medicine or what have you. Assuming that usefulness is a useful perspective, how would you could convince those outside the academy about the existence of liberal arts and the humanities or the Islamic studies?
Right. I suppose maybe, and I've never really had to do this because of our rather sheltered position here, but I suppose I would be saying something like, first of all, if you look at human cultures, you typically find that educated people spend a lot of time studying things whose immediate utility is not obvious. And this is a very common human pattern. And if we want to break with it, we break with it at our peril. It's going to have unintended consequences, and some of those unintended consequences could be very negative. What in a way would be very good would be if some particular country, let's take neither yours nor mine, but let's take Belgium. Let's say that the Belgians went over to a totally utilitarian educational system, and they did that for 20 years, and then we watched the results. My hunch is that there would be some untoward results there. Then the other thing that I would say is that, and this is something that Thomas Friedman keeps saying in his columns in the New York Times, that we're entering a world in which, as where job descriptions keep changing. You can't think in the way you once could of getting into, as it were, learning how to be a cobbler and then being a cobbler for the rest of your life. you know, it's all very fluid, and there is a tremendous premium on versatility. And I don't see what's wrong with the humanities as a way of teaching versatility. I mean, certainly, I'm saying if you take undergraduate students here, they can't simply say, I'm going to study nothing but English literature. That doesn't work here. They have to do some laboratory science. They have to do this. They have to do that. They have to do a language. And they also have to, they will eventually choose a major and concentrate, but they have to do a lot of things before they do that, so that they have to learn how to write papers that I like and how to write papers that people with a completely different mindset in comparative literature like. And I think that's a very good exercise, and it's something that really does pay off. I mean, like the topic sentences of the student that I mentioned before, they helped her in law school. But I don't know what she's doing now, but I imagine she's somewhere in a law firm. And if you can write, that is still a skill that's extremely useful in this world.
And seemingly it just becomes more and more useful because people seems to have their noses in text every minute now in their smartphones.
That's right. What we are doing now is exceptional. What we did before, sending emails, is almost the norm.
Yeah, exactly. So having the skills to put a message in a short form and loud and clear, it's good, I guess, obviously. Before we finish off this interview, I have to ask you the obligatory questions that every prize winner gets. And these are the hard ones, I guess. had you heard of the Holberg Prize before you got the call last week?
Now, when I got the call, I said no. But I think that wasn't actually quite accurate, and I just have a slow memory. I had some awareness that the Norwegians had a big prize. I didn't associate it with the name of Holberg, and to my shame, I didn't then know who Holberg was. Now I do know, and I've read a play of his called The Arabian Powder, and I've checked out what he wrote on Ottoman history and things like that. But at that point, I didn't know the name, so it didn't trigger recognition.
And what will receiving the Holberg Prize mean for you and your ongoing work?
I think this is where I feel very sympathetic to the athletes who were winning gold medals in Sochi not so long ago. And then every single one of them had to face this question. And none of them really had totally convincing answer, and I don't either. I mean, what I could say is that it's an overwhelming honor. Now, the honor part of that is very obvious. The overwhelming part, I suppose, is that if I think back to 15 years ago, I probably had a certain sense of being under-recognized, and I think that that's in a way a very comfortable sense, because you feel that the world owes you something and the world hasn't paid. Whereas now I feel over-recognized, and I feel that I have to pay the world, and I worry about how to do that.
And for your ongoing research or work?
Okay. Now, at this point, I haven't given any serious thought to what to do with the money that comes with the prize. But, I mean, this is, you know, in the terms of the humanities, very serious money for one person, one individual, so to speak, to disperse. And I don't yet have a scheme for it, but I do know my kind of general philosophy of it. Now, I think, say, when I got the Mellon Award, must be sort of all of 10 years ago, a little more, I used quite a lot of that simply to buy myself out of teaching and administration so that I could do the research I wanted to do. And that's what made this possible. Now, I think I would be less inclined to do that, I would be inclined to do less of that and do more of spending the money on trying to nurture the careers of younger scholars. And the question really is how to do that. But one model that impressed me was Quinton Skinner, the intellectual historian who was in Cambridge for so long. He's actually here in Princeton just now. But he won that immense Swiss prize. And what he did with it was to recruit a group of people early in their careers, graduate students, postdocs, and maybe people who had just taken their first position, and to bring them together for a series of conferences. And, I mean, that then produced, I'm not quite sure how many volumes, I have two of them. Okay, so they produced a lot of research. But I think it also produced a lot of camaraderie among people who had somewhat similar interests at a similar stage of their careers. And obviously, they had people to talk to in their home institutions. They went to conferences. But there was something about the way in which this group came together, so, say, every year for several years, that, again, did something in terms of chemistry. So, I mean, that's at least, Quinton is, if you like, a kind of a role model that I have in mind here. But I haven't really seriously started to think.
No, and you had just had a week to think on it. In terms of comparing the answer to the Sochi athletes, I found your answer much better and marvelous.
Thank you for that.
So that was my last question, really. And what's left to me is to thank you for taking the time and effort to have this chat with me. And we are very much looking forward to inviting you to Norway in June for the official Holberg Prize ceremony.
Good. And thank you very much. It's been a pleasure for me. And I look forward to meeting you in person and not in this electronic fashion.
Just basking in my joyful ears now after that oral massage.
Yes, sorry. We shouldn't take the metaphor any further. I feel.
Do you know what it is? You're. I think you're a wee bit high after the shamanic work that we've been doing this morning.
Yeah.
We were involved in a indigenous calling of the spirits and sort of cleansing of the room, which was strange that it was indigenous because it seemed an awful lot like the lesser balancing ritual of the pentagram to me. I mean, I think if native Indians really do relate the four elements to the four directions the same as ceremonial magicians started doing in the late 19th century, I think somebody needs to really investigate that genealogy there. Because I think it's more likely that she learnt it from a Crowley book. Not to be disparaging, but I'm actually, you know, I'm problematizing this notion of indigeneity and whether what we had there was an indigenous practice or in fact an entirely invented or a bricolage of far more recent inventions, in fact.
Oh, indeed, and there were appeals to it was in our DNA, and
the sacred feminine coming back was stated several times.
It was reifying the fact that women are apparently different.
And all indigenous people are also involved with a very modern discourse in ecology.
Yeah.
I find quite strange.
Yeah.
Because it seems to me that they don't so much go around caring for things around them as going out and hunting and eating them.
Yeah.
Which is more or less the same as what we do, really, isn't it?
Not enough ancient aliens.
There's never enough ancient aliens, Chris. Yeah. Never.
So on that sort of critical note, I was also at another conference recently. Listeners will note, I recorded three podcasts at the Irish Society for the Academic Study of Religion, which is a sister society of the BASR. And listeners will note that my accent suddenly becomes much stronger when I'm in my indigenous locality. I'm speaking in the tongue of my people. Next week it's Jay Johnson on the subtle body.
Yeah, that's on the idea of there being a second body made of more spiritual or less dense material, depending on which discourse you're involved in there. It's an idea found in what we might call the Western esoteric tradition, but also in a number of Indian traditions. It was a feature of Gurdjieffian thought as well. So that's going to be very interesting. That interview is by Damon Lycurnos, who's written responses for us before. He's doing some book reviews for us in the future. He's a good friend of the project, our sort of resident occultist.
Yeah.
So that's going to be an interesting one, and we hope to. Hopefully the response will introduce more of the
sort of Eastern religion Hindu aspect into the conversation as well. Damon was also a big help in organising the Ginsberg interview, and he's writing the response for that as well, so you'll have seen him there last week.
Wonderful. Thanks for that, David. Basically, from us from the Wash Bar in Edinburgh, remember to check us out on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, iTunes, Amazon, all the things. And
Yeah. The only thing left to say is
thanks for listening.
Well, thanks for listening.